Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. What happens to kids when their parents struggle, lose their jobs, can't provide, lose their home? The lives of children are often lost in the many statistics about the economy, the job, and the housing market. And during this hour, we'll discuss how kids are doing as the recession goes on. Joining us are Jill Foster, Jan Jackson, and Joanne Wood. Jill Foster serves as Chief of Immunology at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, and she's also heading up the St. Chris New Center for the Urban Child, which will be ready hopefully by the end of next year. Jan Jackson is a senior associate for Kids Count at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and Joanne Wood is a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a faculty member of CHOP's Policy Lab. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And
Thank you.
Jan Jackson, let me start with you. What does the Kids Count report measure? What is it?
The Annie E. Casey Foundation produces a national Kids Count data book, and we've been doing this for the past 22 years. And we show promising progress and discouraging setbacks for the nation's children. We measure 16 different indicators that are available from the federal data sources, and we're able to measure those 16 divided into the domains of economic well-being, education, health, and family and community for all 50 states. So it enables us to tell states, here's what's going on nationally, here's what's going on in your state in these different areas.
And in broad strokes, what were the most important findings of this year's report?
Well, we really found progress in child education and health, but we found continuing disturbing finding in the area of the economic impact of the recession on children. So the good news was we saw improvements in children's health and education, 20% decrease in the number of kids without health insurance. That's the continuing success of the state children's health programs. We also saw a drop in child and teen death, a reduction in the rate of high school students not graduating, all of which is good. But what was disturbing is that kids and families nationwide are still struggling economically in the wake of the recession. In 2010, one-third of all children had parents without secure employment, which is an increase of about 4 million kids in just 2 years. We also saw, between 2000 and 2010, the number of children living in poverty rose by 2.4 million. So right now, one out of five children in America are living in families where a family of four is trying to live on $22,000. 44% are living in families of four, trying to live on $44,000, which is the bare minimum people need in order to just squeeze by.
And how is our region doing as a whole? Of course, WHYY serves Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. Maybe you can just give us a little bit of an image.
Sure. Overall, the state of Pennsylvania ranks 14th out of 50, with one being the state where kids are doing the best and 50th where they're doing the worst. So towards the top, overall child well-being in Delaware ranks 23rd. So they're doing a little bit worse, and those troubling indicators in Delaware are happening in all areas, economic well-being, education, health, and family and community. All of them are in sort of the middle of the pack.
And in New Jersey?
And I'm looking up New Jersey now. Let's see. Just give me a minute. New Jersey actually ranks fourth. So quite a bit of disparity just in a three-state area.
And are you at all concerned that as the number of children living in poverty rises, that some of the other gains that have been made in terms of health and education, that that will be affected negatively?
Well, yes. I mean, it's not just that poverty is driving some of these other areas, but poverty is all related to the national economy. So where we have high rates of joblessness, that puts tremendous amount of emotional stress on families as well as economic distress. But in addition, we've just gone through quite a period where state budgets have been slashed in all of these different states, which means at a time when people normally turn to the public sector for the very best services they need to get through a tough time, those very services are also being cut because of the economy and also because of just sort of the mood in the country to shrink government. So there's really kind of a perfect storm happening right now, all of which can be turned around. We just need the political will and the understanding of what we are able to do in order to improve these outcomes.
Let me turn to the doctors who are joining us here in the studio. Jill Foster, you're at St. Christopher's. Describe where St. Christopher is and who you serve.
Okay, so St. Christopher's is at Erie Avenue in Front Street. It's part of the 1st Congressional District, which is infamous as one of the poorest congressional districts in the whole country. So even though Pennsylvania as a whole, I think, is doing fairly well, the area around St. Christopher's is, there's very high rates of poverty, the rate of children finishing high school is very low. With the poverty comes all the associated things of poverty, of child abuse, violence, substance abuse, health issues, the rate of it's interesting because people look at sort of the social ills or the ones that I just sort of went through, but then those are very closely linked with, you know, childhood asthma, obesity, and so we're really in the epicenter of a lot of, you know, serious health risks for children.
And how have you seen the recession affect that area? Did it get worse than it was before?
Well, that's very interesting because we actually, I think we're sort of the canary in the mine, and we saw the problems happening way before the crash. We started seeing, I work in the HIV program right now, and we saw our rates of HIV going up. We found, you know, more and more of the families that they had kind of been struggling, but kind of pulling it together. And so, you know, the unemployment rate went up there first, rates of homelessness, people who had been just kind of pulling it together on minimum wage jobs. One of the things happened is the rents went up and as the economy sort of got a little better and all of the, you know, all the things happened with mortgages and real estate. So then people were pushed into homelessness. The low-wage jobs always disappear first, and so we lost low-wage jobs. Women ended up, you know, not, you know, having to sort of be on the street a little bit more, and just, you know, then that sort of tumbled into, you know, family chaos.
And Joanne, what have you been observing at Children's Hospital? What do you hear from your colleagues?
So, you know, at Children's Hospital, we didn't notice a huge increase clinically, but we were hearing from our colleagues all across the country that they were seeing increases in admissions to the hospitals for cases of severe physical abuse, so infants with head trauma, with fractures, with serious injuries. And so we were really concerned what was happening to children during the recession. And we had data coming out from the national government, from the Child Protective Services, that said that child abuse was actually going down for the past 15 years and continuing to go down and remain stable during the recession. And that just didn't fit with what clinically we were feeling.
And what you were hearing from across the country.
Correct.
And I want to talk more about the research study you just completed on that very issue in a moment. We're talking about what happens to families and especially what happens to children during the recession and as the recession continues, how children are doing. And Jan Jackson from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, who just completed the Kids Count report, what do we know about how do economic struggles affect family system, increase stress, or how do they affect marriages and all of those things?
Right. Well, it's important to understand that when a parent loses a job or when a parent has inadequate income in order to meet their needs, that there are a series of things that happen that disrupt the family just from a point of view of their outer circumstances. So job loss can result in foreclosure, which is traumatic to children because they literally lose where they're sleeping. They're thrown into having to depend upon others, possibly entering to shelters, all of which can be deeply traumatic to children. There can also be interruptions in the emotional relationship. So increased financial stress can put a strain on marriages where one person may blame the other. There's just an increased atmosphere of tension and anxiety, uncertainty. So parent can start fighting. There can be, I wouldn't say the economy causes domestic violence, but if there is a proclivity within one of the partners to be very controlling or be very abusive, this is yet another environmental circumstance that can contribute to, you know, those patterns of abuse flaring. And then taking out the stress on the child in the form of emotional abuse, physical abuse, and actual neglect, as there are insufficient resources to meet the basic needs of children. Children can become neglected. So it's this is creating a very, very depressing picture, and I just want to continually, as we talk about problems, remind listeners that everything that's going on in the economy right now is a fixable problem. This is we're not doomed to just sort of wait, you know, for the economy to magically fix itself. If employers began hiring people, getting people back to work helps reduce these stresses. And during the interim, there's a number of public programs at the local, state, and federal level that have been shown again and again to lift people out of poverty during tough times.
And we we will talk about those, especially with Jill Foster and the Center for the Urban Child, and also with Joanne Wood. And I wanted to follow up with our two pediatricians who are sitting in the studio. You had a big reaction to the issue of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. Is that something you've seen flare up?
Oh, yes. I particularly like to comment, it doesn't cause it. You know, it's not, you know, all of a sudden you have a foreclosure and now all of a sudden you become someone who abuses your child. Certainly there are, you know, sort of patterns of folks that maybe will have a little bit higher risk of having problems that, you know, with physical abuse of their children. But, you know, a lot of families end up having, you know, I think all families have, you know, you have compensations. You know, everyone, you know, you have your best days and your worst days. And I think that what happens is, you know, with housing stress, with job stress, people drink a little more, people have a shorter fuse, they get more angry, and all of those things, you know, lead to child abuse and domestic violence. And it's very, very difficult in homes. I mean, I think a lot of times people, you know, have pictures of sort of the, you know, unemployed person, or, you know, a picture of the sort of the homeless person as somebody who, you know, can't work, doesn't want to work. I've done work in homeless shelters where, you know, I've watched all the people whose kids are in this homeless, they're living in this homeless shelter, and they're coming home from their jobs. So these are people that are working minimum wage jobs who have worked all day and then come home to their kids in the shelter. And that's going to be really, really difficult. You got one room with one mom and two kids living in one little room in a shelter, you know, she's going to have a shorter fuse.
So there's this constant stress. And Joanne, I do want to get to your research in a moment. We have a break coming up. But what's your take on this flare-up of
clinically, it's something that we see when we take care of kids who are coming into the hospital with injuries. You know, we see families who are really struggling, who are trying to do their best to take care of their families, and they're under a lot of stress. And, you know, sometimes there's the economic stress adds to it, and then there's a trigger. Maybe the baby's crying, the child's having a tantrum, and they lose control. It's not something that's planned, but it's a matter of all the stress is building up.
We're talking about how kids are doing in the recession and what some of the programs are coming up. We'll talk about that can help families and can help children. If you want to call in, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. We'll talk more after our break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, BigBlueMarbleBooks.com.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Coming up on America Abroad.
If you don't have a civil society where kids learn to respect a Christian or a Jew, you're going to have major problems.
How will religious minorities in the Middle East fare in an era of revolution and the rise of Islamist governments? Religious minorities in the Middle East on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Coming up, we begin our series called Brixion. That's fiction from countries on the rise. We start with Brazil and author Clara Averbuch, who takes the girl meets boy can't let him go story to a whole new place.
There is something that annoys me a lot in the female characters. They don't have flaws. Even when they have flaws, they have no contradictions.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, ChesterCountyHospital.org.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the recession and how families and specifically children are doing with these economic struggles going on. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 if you want to join the conversation. Maybe you work with children. Maybe you have seen the effects firsthand. Maybe you have worked on a solution and have found a way to be a positive influence. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Joining us in the studio is Jill Foster from St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. She will be heading up St. Chris's new Center for the Urban Child, which we will be talking about in a moment. It's a very comprehensive approach to healing a lot of the ills that children struggle with. Joanne Wood is with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she's with CHOPS Policy Lab and has recently done some research on serious child abuse and the recession. We'll talk about that in a moment. And also joining us is Jen Jackson. She is with the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and they have just completed their Kids Count report. Thank you all for being here again. And again, if you want to call in, 1-888-477-9499. Joanne Wood, let's get to your research. What did you look at? You said earlier you had heard from a lot of colleagues that they were seeing evidence of child abuse being on the rise.
Right. We were really concerned about what was happening to children and child abuse during the recession. So what we did is we looked at admissions to 38 pediatric hospitals across the country for physical abuse. And so these are young children requiring admission to the hospital, so with severe injuries. And what we found, we looked between a period from 2000 to 2009, and we found an increase in admissions for these severe injuries. And when we looked closer, what we found is that as the rate of home mortgages going into delinquency and going into foreclosure increased in an area, the rate of admissions for physical abuse to the pediatric hospital located in that area went up. And so for us, the study had two main implications. One was that, in contrast to some of the other data, it suggests that child abuse might not be going down in the country and is actually maybe getting worse, or at least that subset of severe injuries in young children. And it also suggested that home foreclosures might be a risk factor for abuse.
What are some other risk factors for abuse? We have talked about some of them, but sum them up again.
Right. So, you know, child abuse is a very complicated, complex issue, of course, and I would never say that something like a home foreclosure caused abuse, right? But we do know there's a long history of research supporting that economic stress, in particular poverty, is a high risk factor for abuse. And basically things that don't provide support. So being a young single parent without family support, drug and alcohol addiction, depression, all those things that make it difficult. You know, raising a child is very difficult and can be stressful. And all those things that prevent parents from having the support and the capacity they need increase the risk.
And what could come out of this report in terms of policy?
So I think I have, you know, two hopes. One would be that we use data from multiple different sources because it's better figure out what's happening to children in the country. Because I think it's really important if we're going to design and evaluate prevention services, know who to target, who is at risk the most for abuse, help them, and then find out and evaluate, are we actually helping them? We really need to have an accurate count of the number of kids who are being abused in this country. And I don't think it's all going to be hospital data, but I think we need to use hospital data, data from Child Protective Services, and blend it all together so we can get the most accurate picture. The second one, as you know, the study, of course, doesn't tell us how to solve this, but the second one is about foreclosures and economic risk to these kids. And at the community level, better linking up all the services so that we can get help families before they get to the child abuse and child welfare system. So when I'm a pediatrician seeing a family in the office, asking about economic stress, asking how they're doing, and if I identify a family that's struggling, link them up to services so that they can get counseling, so they can get parenting support, so they can get help with food and housing. So I'm really excited actually to hear about Jill's project.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a moment. But let me ask you, are the services there? Jan Jackson, maybe that's something you could weigh in on as well. Are services there to support families, struggling families?
Well, I think that services are needed in a number of areas. One, and this is something where we need everyone to sort of step forward and start rowing in the same direction. There's clearly a role for the private sector in jump-starting employment. Just a data point, which is our large corporations, not banks, but corporations in America, are sitting on $2 trillion worth of cash. They don't want to start hiring because they're afraid that people won't buy their goods. And it's a vicious cycle. People can't buy their goods because they're not working. So there needs to be a conversation with the private sector about how we can jumpstart employment, because the best prevention for homelessness and for hunger and all the rest is when families can support themselves. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. While we're waiting for business to start hiring, we have to have a conversation about what public supports are needed, including unemployment, food stamps, child care, cash assistance. If we don't want half of all children growing up permanently in poverty, we have to have a robust set of public supports to meet their basic needs. Now, services can come from nonprofit sector, they can come from churches, and they can come from the public sector. Hands down, the public sector has more resources to provide these services. And we've been in a five-year pattern of just slashing and burning state budgets, saying that, you know, small government is good. We now have like a $300,000 fewer teachers than we need in our classrooms. We are seeing cuts in social service programs, you know, across the board. And the country's getting ready to face a number of really massive federal fiscal decisions, which have a huge impact on these struggling families. So I would just say for those listening, kids can't vote. We have to really represent them. And this is an election where we really need to know what people are, what kind of platform they're running on, and what they'll do to help solve some of these problems moving forward.
Is there a way, do you see evidence of people trying, and maybe let me ask you, Jill, with this new project, is there a way to do services better? Often, especially when you cover, which I do as a reporter, this region, you see a lot of service providers. Some of them seem to be doing all the same stuff. Nobody seems to be talking to each other. Nobody is connected. And you wonder sometimes, can't this be done better? So talk about your mission with the Center for the Urban Child and where some of the frustrations are in the fragmented services.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, the Center for the Urban Child is both a building, so we're building a new building. We're making an investment in a brand new shiny building that is going to serve the patients that bring in the least revenue. So that was, you know, a commitment that came from, you know, the from Tenet.
So your parent company.
Our parent company, yes. So, and actually from the CEO himself, Trevor Fetter is the one who was really, a lot of this is sort of his brainchild of there must be a better way to do this. The second part of it is the people. So the people that are, so you have to have a building that is going to work. So one of the things that we're building into the building is, you know, streamline ways for people to get in, because people who work low-wage jobs, you know, they don't have a lot of time to sit in your waiting room. They don't have time to come and spend the whole morning there and have to discipline their kids while they're sitting in there. So we're streamlined processes. You want to have it be that if they're in an exam room and a problem gets identified, then it's not that you're now going to send them someplace else. So what we have, we already have the medical legal partnership, what Dr. Lee Pachter brought in, and I know you're familiar with that, is that, you know, if they identify a legal issue, then there's an exam, a consultation room right down the hall, so you walk them down the hall. They're not going to have like, oh, here's a referral and here's a lawyer that you're going to have to now take another day off from work. You know, we can do it right there. So it's one-stop shopping model that as many services as we can pack into this building with as many people to help people navigate through the services we're going to do.
So legal is one. What other services?
We're planning to bring in mental health services. We have domestic violence counseling on site. We have enhanced HIV testing on site. And those are the things that we have right now. I mean, one of the neat things about this initiative is that we already at St. Chris, because of the neighborhood we live in, have all these services. And some people over here, you know, the asthma program is doing lots of good stuff with asthma prevention. And the people over here are doing this project. And so one of the things that this brings in is it brings everybody in under under one umbrella, so that we have a steering committee that is, you know, we're coordinating what we're doing. We can share, hey, this worked in the asthma clinic. Maybe the same thing will work in the rheumatology clinic. And so we're going to, you know, have these shared lessons. A lot of us have community collaborators that we work with, that I have a group that I'm working with HIV, and the same people are working with a special needs clinic, maybe on mental health or, you know, children's educational projects. And so, you know, everybody's sitting around the table, pooling our resources, making sure that everybody is sort of doing the same thing. The next part of it, which I think really makes this unique and really has come from a lot of support from the leadership of the hospital, is that we are making the entire hospital be a health disparity informed hospital. You know, whether you're the person in the cafeteria that is cooking food to serve to the people who come or the inpatients, or whether you're the CEO of the hospital, everybody is making a commitment to be very aware of what are the things that we do that might be barriers to our patients and get rid of them. What are the things that we could do to make it better, and who else do we need to bring in? And we're, you know, sitting together in mixed groups of people, really trying to problem solve and get everybody's view, you know, because, you know, I'm not the one who spends the most time in the patient's room. The nurses may spend time, or it may be the person that delivers the food who someone says to them, you know, hey, you know, that just doctor just told me such and such. What do you think about that? And that we can get that kind of an input.
Can you give us an example of these barriers to care? We hear about that all the time. Of course, health insurance is one, cost is another. But what are some other issues that might prevent a person from really getting the care and help they need?
Well, I mean, a huge barrier is people's economic circumstances. You know, if somebody, you know, if somebody's going to come see us in an appointment, they're going to have to take time off from work. You know, a lot of folks are working under the table jobs. There's no such thing as getting family medical leave. So, you know, you work at a dry cleaner getting minimum wage and you want to take your kid in for shots, you know, you're going to have to take time off from work. You're going to have to take two or three buses. You're going to miss the whole afternoon. And, you know, likely your employer's going to say, hey, there's plenty of people around here that don't have kids that need to go to the doctor, and I'm just going to hire them instead. And so then you have to make choices about what is it that you're going to, you know, are you going to be able to take your child for their needed issues? And then if you have a child that has something more complicated, even something kind of as simple as asthma, you know, they're now going to require extra visits. You may have to take off to go to the emergency room. And so people that are working at already sort of borderline economic circumstances, now with just a little bit worsening of the economy, now, you know, now they, you know, can't make their rent payment, can't make their mortgage payment. Now we're homeless, and now we're trying to organize this all out of a homeless shelter. So I think that's the biggest barrier I see.
And what can you do about that?
Well, we can be more flexible in our hours. Mm-hmm. We can, you know, make the commitment to get them through faster. One of the ideas that we're looking at is using health navigators to help them on the things outside of our clinic. So in my clinic, we have a woman, Lolita, who's an assistant case manager, who she helps people go to the welfare office to get, you know, when they inevitably it gets turned off because she moved and their, you know, paperwork didn't catch up with her. So we want to do things that are both at our site, but then actually do things out in the community that'll help people navigate all these what seems like often ridiculous hurdles that people have to do. I mean, our visit's quick compared to the amount of time that they may spend down, you know, trying to get their, you know, food stamps or Medicaid turned back on.
Now, Joanne, let me turn to you, since one of your key issues is child abuse. What should happen when a child comes in having been abused by a parent? What should be happening?
I think, you know, one of the key parts, obviously, is the medical care of the child. Mm-hmm. But then also the, you know, the goal of the system is to preserve families and to help support families as possible. So there, you know, we've worked on a lot of collaborative projects with the city of DHS in Philadelphia. And I think they're doing a lot of wonderful initiatives to improve the care to the children. And in particular, so what Jill was talking about, to make it more centralized. So their new initiative of localizing the care and the services in the children's community and making sure that all the different services and supports that are provided to those families are better coordinated. Because there's a lot of things that a family might need, and they do a thorough assessment. They might need drug and alcohol counseling. They might need parenting classes. They might need mental health support, child care. So really what should happen is providing all those different supports to the family to make it work, to help them take care of the child. And sometimes that's not possible, and then the children do need to go into an alternative placement, whether that's foster care or kinship care. And I think if you know, the city has done a remarkable job, actually, with reducing the number of kids that are going into foster care and helping to support families so that the kids can stay with their families.
But let me ask you, who makes the call where the child will go?
So, you know, as a pediatrician, when I see a child who's injured, it's a mandatory reporter. It's my responsibility to call Child Protective Services. And then they investigate and make a determination. And it's their responsibility to make a determination of what services the child needs, what's going to keep the child safe, and where the child goes.
And then you no longer have any part of that.
Correct. I provide the medical information.
And is that frustrating? Because we're just talking about combining these services. So here you are, you have a child that you took care of, that you have a relationship with, and then you hand it off to somebody, and you don't know what happens to that child, and you might see that child again in a month.
So I think, you know, there could be better communication in terms of what's going on, but there's actually been a lot of initiatives in the city to improve communication and follow up. And I serve on a multidisciplinary committee every other week where we review cases of severe child abuse. And there's input from the medical, from the school, from behavioral health, from DHS, from the ME's office, from all these different groups to sit down and think about how were the services provided to this family, and is there something we could have done better? And there's also, I think there's going to be a press conference today about the groundbreaking for a new child advocacy center in the city of Philadelphia, which isn't for the physical abuse, but, you know, more focused on the sexual abuse, which I think is wonderful because it's about co-locating the services provided to children who are victims of sexual abuse, which is a great thing because they're not having to go all over the city to different centers to see the police, to see DHS, to see all the different, have their forensic interview. They're working on making a co-located to really make that stressful process easier for families.
And the cases, we are coming up on a break, but the cases we often hear about in the news are the absolute worst cases that end often in the death of a child. But talk about the kind of abuse you see and what the families, whether you think, you know, with a bit of help in this family, that wouldn't happen again. Because when we hear a case on the news, it's often this has been going on for a year. But you must be seeing families where you feel like, okay, if they hadn't been in this or that situation, that wouldn't have happened.
Right. And it's, you know, I see the kids who come into the hospital, so I see the worst of the worst, which isn't typical. It's not representative of the vast majority of children that DHS and other Child Protective Service agencies are caring for. And we certainly see children who have been abused severely and who, you know, honestly, services to the family may not work out. But we do see them where the families have been really struggling and have been trying to provide care to the family and sort of reach their limit. Or we may even see kids where mom's got to work and she can't lose her job or she can't support her family, and she had to leave her child with maybe someone who wasn't the best choice of childcare. And so
it all works together. But are you feeling that these kind of services are coming together in some way?
Yeah. I don't, you know, it's not perfect, as you know. and there's still, you know, unfortunately, we do have bad outcomes and things that in retrospect, maybe we could have done better. But I really think, you know, I've been in Philly for a while at CHOP, and I think over the past several years, there's been a lot of really important changes and a lot of things for the better.
We're talking about how children are doing with the recession and what some of the biggest issues are that are affecting children negatively. We'll talk more after our break. If you want to call in, 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
WHYY's original production, The Barnes Collection, is attracting the attention of the nation. The Wall Street Journal says it's a fabulous account of Albert C. Barnes, and the glory of his achievement and assembled works really does make your heart sing. The Seattle Times highlighted The Barnes Collection as their critic's pick, and The Week magazine named it as their show of the week, The Barnes Collection, part of the PBS Arts Summer Festival, tonight at 9 on WHYY-TV.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to excerpts of our interviews with Gore Vidal from 1988 and 1992. He died Tuesday at the age of 86. Also, an interview with Lee Maynard. His new novel, The Scummers, is the third in his trilogy about growing up in West Virginia. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Republican Karl Rove reinvented the business of political finance by revamping the Democrats' playbook. Now he might swing the election for the GOP. Also, we preview Monday's scheduled landing of the rover Curiosity on Mars. Will it make it to the surface safely? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about how kids are doing in the recession and what some organizations locally are doing to help families as they struggle with unemployment and maybe losing their homes. Joining us in the studio is Jill Foster. She is with St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, and she'll be heading up St. Chris's new Center for the Urban Child that we've been talking about a little bit. Also joining us is Joanne Wood from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she's also with the Policy Lab and has recently completed some work on serious child abuse and the recession. And we're joined on the phone by Jan Jackson, who is with the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and they recently completed their Kids Count report, which takes measure of all kinds of different things, education, healthcare, how kids are doing. And before our break, we were talking about child abuse. And Jill Foster, that brings up a bit of an issue of trust, because sometimes when you're dealing with struggling families, you as the pediatricians, the doctors, are the ones who have to maybe report them. So where does that take your relationship then?
It's a really difficult situation. Trust is a very fragile thing. So, I mean, one of the things about everything we try to do in primary care is to build trust with our patients so that when something happens, hopefully you already have a relationship with them where that they trust that at least, even if they may be disagreeing with you right now when you're saying, I really need to call DHS because of issues with your child, that, you know, you have a little bit of a relationship, which I think, you know, is different in the primary care setting. A lot of the issues that we have are around not the serious physical abuse, but more sort of neglect. You know, the child with asthma who the mom isn't giving the medicines, the child with HIV who, you know, isn't making it to appointments or isn't getting the medicines. And so you end up doing a lot of negotiation. We'll file with DHS. DHS will come in. They'll say, yeah, there's a problem here. They'll put services in. And then, you know, a week later, you're now seeing the same child that you just, you know, DHS is now in their lives. And most of them, at least initially, are not very happy with that. And so it really involves, you know, showing, you know, sort of, you know, walking the walk and talking the talk, is that you have to spend a lot of time in discussing it, but then you also have to show, again, you know, back to the stuff I was talking about before, that you're going to have supportive services as well for them, and you need to show things that you're respecting them and respecting their time.
And when you're talking about the Center for the Urban Child, this is really a comprehensive approach. So you're thinking, in a way, it seems to be taking on the healing of a community, in a sense.
Yes, absolutely. And we're going from the part of there's a lot of underlying factors, you know, violence, parenting issues, you know, community chaos. We're working at those issues, and then at the other end, we're also trying to come up with the models of how do we deliver the care the best, and, you know, and with those meeting in the middle of, you know, trying to solve the problems of low literacy, so, you know, people aren't going to go online and just look up their illness, you know, health literacy, a lot of people not understanding about, you know, accessing your clinic during sick hours, maybe, and just the overall issues of, you know, the access issues we talked about before. But no, we're really trying to attack it from every direction.
And Jan Jackson, what are some of your thoughts on the generational aspect of poverty? There's now this generation of kids growing up during a recession, some of them really struggling. What will that do for their chances as they become adults?
Well, I think that's one of the things that has us really deeply concerned. Because we know that the impact of that, there's many things that can contribute to toxic stress for kids. Child maltreatment, certainly one of them, but long-term poverty also has deep effects on children. We're now looking at all these, you know, foreclosures, domestic violence. All these things have deep impacts on children's intellectual, emotional development. But I want to end this program on a hopeful note, if we can, because it's really important for those of us who are listening to realize there's 73 million children in America. They're 24% of the American population and 100% of America's future. And we, wherever we go, we're going to go there together in this country. And so for those of us who do have a voice and do have a vote and can make a difference in our own child's life, in the children of our family and our neighborhood, it's really imperative right now that we do what we can to help promote resilience, to help promote love, concern, well-being. We shouldn't minimize the impact that adults caring for children has to help them develop resilience. And we also have a powerful responsibility to sort of lift our head up from, you know, the particular aspect of this crisis that's facing us and do what we can to ignite a national conversation. In England, they had a national conversation that led to the entire country saying that they were going to cut poverty in half within a certain period of time. And they made really great progress in doing that, using some of the same policies that we have in this country. But they said, we're going to hold hands and we are going to do this as a nation. I think we're at that point in America where we need to ignite that kind of national conversation. It's not sustainable to have half of all families in America living, you know, with their, you know, bare-knuckled trying to get from paycheck to paycheck. But we need different ways of structuring the employment in America so it's family-friendly. We need higher wages. We need public systems that really work for families in some of the really beautiful ways that Dr. Foster described. We know what to do, but it's really up to us to, you know, help give those running for office the mandate to work with them to make it happen.
Let me invite Barbara from Wayne to join our conversation. Hi, Barbara. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello. I just have a simple question. What is the country and what organizations like you do to actually prevent child abuse before the child is born, which we talking about teaching the kids in high school, boys and girls, talking to them about their issues and pull out the people who already have problems at that stage in their life to prevent their child abuse?
Is there a way, I mean, you've mentioned, thank you, Barbara, for that call. Joanne, you've mentioned some of the risk factors. So is that happening where people who might be at risk during pregnancy already?
Right. Sure. There's a lot of programs that have been shown to be effective. They probably aren't reaching as many families as need them. But one of the ones that's through many parts of Pennsylvania is the Nurse Family Partnership, which identifies high-risk first-time moms and provides home nursing visits throughout pregnancy and early on in the child after the child's birth to help educate the mom about the care of the child and development. And it's been shown to have multiple outcomes, both for the mom and for the child, one of which is decreasing child abuse, but also increasing the time to second pregnancy, decreasing smoking during pregnancy, and lifetime outcomes for the child. So the children who were born during this are less likely to be incarcerated and have really good outcomes. So there are really good programs out there. I think we just need to get them to more families because there's a lot of families who need them.
And Jill, this brings up another issue, which is the issue of birth control. When we're talking about poverty, nothing pushes a family or especially a single mother into poverty more quickly than having another child. So will that be an issue that will come up at the Center for the Urban Child as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of the Center for the Urban Child is our adolescent clinic, where we're, you know, part of, you know, Family Planning Council's program for being able to provide contraception to children. And, you know, all of that is under attack right now. It used to be that you could pretty much, you know, it's in my professional lifetime, we could guarantee that if a poor teenager wanted to get birth control, that she would be able to come in and be able to access it for free, regardless of her insurance, and that is certainly under threat, which is a problem. Wider than that, though, is that, you know, we're coming out of a period, I'm hoping we're coming out of a period of you know, being afraid to talk to kids about sex. And so, you know, I talked about the case of a teenager wanting to come in to get birth control, but there's a lot of misinformation out there that there's kids now coming in saying, well, I don't need to, you know, I'm not going to use birth control. Pregnancy's going to happen or not happen. And, you know, I heard in this abstinence program that I was in that birth control doesn't really even work that well anyway, so why should I even take it? And there's, you know, been some very good studies that, you know, have really looked at that the the actual information that teens have about sexual health has really declined.
But what about women who are not teens? Sometimes we're talking maybe about a woman who's in her 20s and her 30s who has two kids, and then having another kid can push her over the edge economically. Right. So will that conversation come up as well there?
Sure. one of the things we've actually even been talking is our OBGYN colleagues is getting our adult OBGYN colleagues involved in, you know, providing services on site, which is, you know, all of this is very, you know, early in its inception. But yeah, I mean, we have a family-centered model. I mean, in the HIV clinic, we actually see the parents and give the parents birth control there and provide their HIV care all in the same center. I mean, clearly St. Chris is, you know, our mission first is children. But, you know, but we also are family-centered. And so we're going to provide those services that we need.
And what kind of response are you getting from the community? You've mentioned that you're working with community organizations. So is there a sense of excitement and wanting to get in on the action?
Oh,
with this
absolutely
new urban?
There is. You know, I had intended to start this out a little bit slower and with a little less fanfare. And
the Center for the Urban Child.
Yes. And a little bit more of a planning process. I mean, all the components are there, but I mean, my inbox is stuffed with congratulations and people that we have worked with and that we know who are like, how can we be part of it? How can we be help of it? We had town hall meetings that our CEO gave this week, and you know, they were packed with people who are enthusiastic about this process and suggesting, hey, I work with such and such a community group, are they on board? And there's just has been this incredible outpouring of support.
And the center will also provide jobs, which
yes.
seems to be, I mean,
yes.
this is a whole chicken and egg conversation on some
yes.
level, but the jobs definitely yes. make a difference.
Yes, and jobs hopefully from the neighborhood as well. I mean, I think, you know, one of the models that I particularly like is, you know, a peer network navigator roles where you hire women, and again, we have that in the HIV program already, and have a lot of models in HIV of how to bring community and consumer support into what you do, and you know, get folks in the community in and trained, and you know, people with skills to help, you know, their neighbors, you know, be able to navigate these systems.
Now, when conversations like this are, when people listen to conversations like this, often people want to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So what can people do if you want to help a child, whether you're an employer or just a neighbor? A lot of times I'll sit on the bus and I see a family that is clearly struggling, but I don't know what to do. Should I reach over and do what?
That's a very good question. I think that in Philadelphia, we have a lot of really good organizations that provide our safety net that are nonprofit organizations. And I think depending on which, you know, I don't want to sort of call out sort of my favorites, but I mean, I think you probably know, and it's very easy to figure out, you know, which ones are the really good organizations. I mean, the one that pops up that's in our direct neighborhood that does so much is Congreso de Latinos Unidos. I mean, they're just, you know, give to those organizations because those organizations are the ones who know how to do it. And a lot of times people are doing sort of like, you know, I'll start a foundation, you know, or I'll start, you know, I and my own will go do something. But, you know, there's organizations in North Philly and West Philly that they know what they're doing and they're doing a really good job, but they're struggling, especially another issue with the economy's got worse, donations have gone
right.
down.
But what about time? Can people give time?
Oh, absolutely.
Places?
These organizations love to have volunteers. There's, you know, St. Christopher's Foundation for Children has a farm to families program where every week we give for $10 that people can use their food stamps for, we give boxes of fresh fruit to people. Well, somebody has to help, you know, put the fruit in those boxes. Farmers donate or give at lower price the fruit and the vegetables, and, you know, somebody has to fill those boxes every week. And so, you know, it doesn't feel like you necessarily may have close, you know, as you would, you know, close to close, but, you know, the boxes are given out right down the hall from me, and you would see the incredible stream of people coming in who want to have fresh fruits and vegetables for their family. But we're at a food desert in North Philly and neighborhoods in West Philly that there's just not there's no place to go that's close to their home to get them.
Joanne, any input
yeah.
on that?
I think those are fabulous ideas. And I think, you know, also just on a personal level, in your interactions with people you work with, ask them how they're doing. And, you know, simple things. If you have a friend with a new baby who's stressed, providing a little support, a little time off, all those things can be really important. And there's a lot of people in the city who, you know, are big brothers, big sisters to kids mm-hmm. and work with them. And that sort of mentoring relationship, all the wonderful foster parents who take care of children in the city do an amazing job because it's really those personal bonds and those really help children have resilience.
And Jen Jackson has mentioned the importance of employers. What could employers do, simple things that would make life so much easier for their employees?
Well, the employers could, you know, a lot of it, you know, comes from compassion. You know, the story of the mom that I told who's going to get fired because she takes her kid to the office. I mean, you know, all of us had mothers who took care of us. All of us benefited from having a mother who was able to take care of us. And yet many employers are denying children the ability to have a mother who could really take care of them. You know, it's to be able to give reasonable benefits so that if the business can afford it, you know, to pay people and to give them the benefits so that they can have health insurance and be able to go to the doctor. You know, to pay a decent living wage to people. I mean, even on minimum wage, it's very hard for a family to survive on minimum wage. At the end of the month, there's, you know, with a family of a single mom with two kids, I did the calculations. I think it's like, you know, $60 left over at the end of the month after you pay rent to be able to buy everything else you need to buy for your family. Those are the biggest things that I can come up with.
And Jen Jackson, just a few seconds left. What are some things people or organizations can do to help struggling families?
Well, I would agree. I really want to applaud the other speakers on the phone. It's been tremendously inspiring. And if you want to get involved in advocacy, just go to Kids Count Pennsylvania, Kids Count New Jersey, Kids Count Delaware, and they'll get you hooked up with what you can do in the next 6 months.
All right, and Jill Foster, before we go, when will the Center for the Urban Child open?
Well, I mean, virtually it's open because right. We've already started the process. It's expected that the actual building will be open at the end of 13.
All right, and that is Jill Foster with St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, who will be heading up the new Center for the Urban Child, and we'll look forward to visiting it. We also had in the studio Joanne Wood. She's a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and with CHOPS Policy Lab. And also joining us was Jen Jackson with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Thank you all so much for being with us here on Radio Times. And I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowitz, and you've been listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.